A butler stands at the end of his life, looking back across decades of impeccable service, only to discover he may have served the wrong master all along. This is the haunting premise of Kazuo Ishiguro's masterpiece, a novel that asks uncomfortable questions about loyalty, dignity, and the stories we tell ourselves to make our choices bearable. Stevens, our narrator, embarks on a rare motoring trip through 1950s England, ostensibly to visit a former colleague. But what begins as a simple journey becomes something far more profound, a reckoning with a life spent perfecting the art of self-denial. The brilliance lies in how Ishiguro reveals character through what remains unsaid. Stevens describes his devotion to greatness in butlering with such earnestness that we barely notice the tragedy underneath. A man who has confused emotional suppression with moral strength, who has mistaken self-erasure for dignity. As the English countryside unfolds before him, so too does the landscape of his past, revealing not the triumph he believes it to be, but a series of devastating choices made in service to an ideal that never truly existed. What makes someone truly great at their profession? Stevens obsesses over this question, convinced that the answer lies in something called dignity, the ability to inhabit one's role so completely that personal feelings become irrelevant. Stevens recalls his father serving dinner to the very general responsible for his brother's death, maintaining perfect composure that earned an unusually large tip. This represents the pinnacle of achievement to Stevens. His other examples are equally unsettling. A butler in India calmly announces a tiger beneath the dining table before ensuring dinner proceeds without disruption. Another confronts drunken guests through silent, imposing presence alone. In each case, dignity means complete suppression of natural human response, fear, grief, anger, in favor of flawless performance. The tragedy is that Stevens genuinely believes this represents moral strength rather than self-abandonment. The 1923 International Conference represents both his greatest professional triumph and most devastating personal loss. When informed of his father's death during the final dinner, Stevens declines to go upstairs, asking Miss Kenton to close his father's eyes instead. "My father would have wished me to carry on," he explains, before returning immediately to serve port in the smoking room. Miss Kenton disrupts Stevens' ordered world from her first uninvited entrance to his pantry, bearing flowers to brighten things up. Her gesture represents everything he's avoided: spontaneity, warmth, the acknowledgement that even a butler might want beauty. His polite refusal establishes their dynamic, her attempts to reach the human beneath the professional veneer, his retreat behind duty's fortress. Their confrontations crackle with unacknowledged tension. When she discovers he's reading a romance novel, she's penetrated his defenses, glimpsed the emotional life he denies. His embarrassment reveals his philosophy's cost. Even simple pleasures must be hidden, as if any inner life threatens his professional identity. Miss Kenton isn't simply warm where Stevens is cold. She possesses her own professional pride, but understands something Stevens cannot. Excellence need not require sacrificing one's humanity. When she stands outside the summer house after their argument about the dismissed Jewish maids, her silhouette in the mist represents all the connection he cannot accept. He sees her there, knows she's upset, and does nothing, because acknowledging her distress would mean acknowledging his own feelings. When she announces her suitor's proposal, Stevens responds with professional courtesy, offering congratulations as if she'd reported a successful dinner service. Lord Darlington embodies well-intentioned catastrophe. Devastated by Germany's post-World War suffering, especially after witnessing his friend Herr Bremen's suicide, he devoted himself to revising the Versailles Treaty's harshest terms. By 1922, he'd assembled an impressive alliance at his estate: Professor Keynes, H.G. Wells, various lords and diplomats, all committed to preventing future conflict through compassionate policy. His fatal flaw wasn't initial compassion, but his inability to recognize when it was being manipulated. What's particularly chilling is Stevens' response to Darlington's anti-Semitic period. Instructed to dismiss two Jewish housemates, Stevens tells an outraged Miss Kenton that their professional duty is not to our own foibles and sentiments, but to the wishes of our employer. He suggests that Darlington, moving in circles where these high affairs of the nation are discussed, is better positioned to judge the nature of Jewry in this complicated and treacherous world. It's a perfect illustration of how abdication of moral judgment, dressed up as professional excellence, becomes complicity in evil. The novel's most heartbreaking thread is the unacknowledged love between Stevens and Miss Kenton. Their relationship unfolds through charged moments, flowers brought to his pantry, the precise way she held her head, watching his father pace before the summer house. The most haunting image is Stevens standing outside Miss Kenton's door, certain she's crying within, but unable to offer comfort. Physical proximity combined with emotional distance, deep feeling rendered inexpressible by professional constraints and personal inhibition. When they reunite decades later, Miss Kenton, now Mrs. Ben, confesses, "I get to thinking about a life I may have had with you, Mr. Stevens." Stevens, devastated but still unable to express his feelings, can only encourage her to look forward to happy years with her grandchildren. What makes this love story so affecting is its restraint. No passionate declarations, no dramatic reunions, just two people who loved each other but lacked the courage to say so. The tragedy isn't that circumstances kept them apart, but their own inability to be honest. Stevens proves himself an unreliable narrator, not through deliberate deception, but through self-protective blindness. His recollections contain revealing contradictions. When describing Miss Kenton's confrontation about his father's decline, he suddenly questions whether she spoke so boldly at that early stage, suggesting his memory has been colored by later events. When recounting Darlington's anti-Semitic period, he minimizes its significance while simultaneously providing disturbing details. This narrative technique illustrates how memory serves not just as record, but as tool. We construct versions of the past that we can live with. Stevens needs to believe his sacrifices were meaningful, his employer honorable, his professional dedication true dignity, rather than misplaced loyalty. The most poignant moment comes when Stevens reflects on turning points in his relationship with Miss Kenton. When, with the benefit of hindsight, one begins to search one's past for such turning points, one is apt to start seeing them everywhere, he observes. This insight reveals both growing awareness and continued reluctance. He sees the turning points now, understands their significance, yet still frames them as unforeseeable rather than acknowledging his own role in missing them. On Weymouth Pier, Stevens' composure finally cracks. "I've given what I had to give. I gave it all to Lord Darlington," he confesses to another retired butler. Then comes his devastating realization. At least he had the privilege of being able to say at the end of his life that he made his own mistakes. As for myself, I cannot even claim that. His tragedy isn't serving a discredited employer, it's abdicating responsibility for his own moral choices. Yet the novel closes with modest hope. The elderly butler advises Stevens to stop looking back and enjoy what remains. Watching the pier lights come on, Stevens reflects, "Perhaps then, there is something to his advice that I should cease looking back so much and try to make the best of what remains of my day." His resolution to practice bantering represents a small step toward authenticity. We all serve something, a career, an ideology, an image of who we should be. The question is whether we're serving the right master and whether our commitment has eclipsed the person underneath. The real tragedy isn't making mistakes. It's reaching the end and realizing you never really made choices at all.